702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
7 minutes past 6 o'clock on the 11th of November. It is The Money Show with myself, Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield. It's brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Fueling tomorrow's energy today at Africa Oil Week. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The medium-term budget policy statement perhaps flatters to deceive for the most part. Nothing really exciting other than the fact that we're saying again that state-owned entities are not going to be receiving funding from government. They say the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So how much more will all those other entities then eat into the government fiscus, if nothing? We're saying no more, but already they've sat us back with quite an extensive array. Let's remember that we still have over 350 billion rand worth of guarantees that are going to Eskom. So even if we don't give them more money, we're still paying the interest that all of that has effectively always going to cost us at some stage by the seams of it. And we're still saying to them, well, there's a 131 billion rand that is coming through from European partners and the United States with regards to green energy. Will that be sufficient in order to change them away from coal and back into this green sphere that we want to get into? How much more will that aid South Africa, if any at all? Fiscal consolidation is still the aim of the game by the seams of things. But how much can we really get out of it at this stage? We've tried the same thing for so many years, and we're still doing it again. I wonder what Einstein used to say about repeating yourself and doing the same thing over and over. I wonder what it was called back then. So we'll unpack that medium-term budget policy statement just a little bit more. The finance minister, not so keen by the looks of it on that basic income grant, and really saying growth is the best way to really get South Africa going. But we don't have any. So where do we find it? Are we going on an Easter egg hunt now? Is that what's going to happen? Where to from here? We'll unpack the budget, the results then from MultiChoice as well, seemingly getting themselves into a really good sense of where they sit in that video entertainment market. So much more coming through across the next 2 hours. Do stay with us. Let's unpack it all. First up, though, here's your medium-term budget policy statement review.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Look, if you're not going to get the finance minister, the next best person is certainly the director general, the man who is effectively the CEO of South Africa's finances. That is Dondo Mokgatjane, the director general at National Treasury. Dondo, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it this evening. It's a budget that, again, stinks of fiscal consolidation. Is that still the aim? Good evening, Dondo. Dondo, can you hear us? Seem to be having just a little bit of an issue there with Dondo's line. For now then, let's maybe head on over to Edward Kieswetter, the commissioner at the South African Revenue Service. Mr. Kieswetter, thank you so much for your time here. Your statement reads, of course, in welcoming and supporting that medium-term budget policy statement. It's 120 billion rand that you'll be able to help add to the fiscus for the finance minister to be able to use then. It won't necessarily, you know, curb all our issues, but it certainly is a helpful one, right?
Of course, Arabile. Every additional rand that can be collected goes to funding very important social programs. And in the short term, we know that there is a huge need for protecting many vulnerable South Africans from being destitute. So we are very pleased that the fact that South African Revenue Services could exceed the initial estimate that the minister gave in February and confidently to project that we will exceed that by the end of this year indeed plays an important part to filling that hole on behalf of South Africans. But of course, 120 billion is a stretched target. It's not a walk in the park, as no revenue collection is. We are thankfully buoyed by a better than expected recovery in the economy, specifically growth in the mining sector from the commodity pricing cycle and production.
Yeah.
But we also are pleased with the growing confidence that the rebuilding project of SARS has which is obviously improving our capacity to enforce the laws and to administer to the extent to collect additional revenue.
That rebuild is certainly going to need personnel as well. You have unfortunately lost quite a few over the years. Is that sort of rebuild also happening in that sense? Because the efficiency of SARS will determine whether the fiscus can keep up.
Well, yes. So you may recall in February the minister announced that SARS would be getting an extra billion rand. I can tell you that a third of that, just over 300 million, is in fact used to hire additional staff in specialized areas in both tax and customs. It's hard to find good people, but that is progressing. But also the balance of that billion is to accelerate modernization in both our tax and customs systems, which has fallen behind in latter years. And then very importantly, you know, today we cannot do our work without the ability to analyze data, to collect and analyze data, and to impose artificial intelligence on it that helps us to detect risk, to connect dots that otherwise human beings couldn't. That work in it alone, for example, have allowed us to identify taxpayers who are not registered.
Yeah.
We've been able to stop over 30 billion of attempts at refund fraud. That's 30 billion that ends up in the fiscus instead of being paid out to illegal taxpayers.
Sure,
we are making progress steady, slow, but steadily.
Yeah. Mr. Keyswetter, appreciate the time. Thank you so much. All the best for it. You're certainly going to have a hard task and a hard graft ahead of you as well as you aim to try and get as much of that 120 billion. The aim is to collect as much as, 1.485 billion. Billion rand, so 1.4 trillion effectively, more than that, close to 1.5 trillion really, as an economy. Certainly a tough task ahead. Mr. Mokgajane, hopefully joining us now. Dondo, the Director General at National Treasury. Hopefully you can hear me now, Dondo. The question I was asking a little earlier was really around whether fiscal consolidation is still the best way for this economy to work. I ask that as perhaps somebody who's seen this happen and seen this as a part of our fiscal journey from at least 2011 or so, and yet we still haven't achieved our goals.
Yes, thank you, Arabilan. Thank you. Good afternoon to your listeners. Yes, fiscal consolidation is still the hallmark of our fiscal strategy and fiscal policy stance currently as things are. And obviously, one expects that when the economy begins to really fire in all engines, then we can talk a different language in terms of how then do we deploy our strategy differently to aim at certain things. Now, yes, it is. It is currently. We have to consolidate until at a point when we're just speaking to the commissioner now. We are giving some resources. We have to collect more. We have to ensure that the economy fires in all cylinders. In that way, then we can revisit the strategy that you have adopted since 2011. You're correct.
So, I mean, if you do the same thing over and over and it doesn't work, surely a change is necessary. And I say that just because for 12 years nearly now, we're doing the same thing over and over and we're not getting anywhere. Should we relook at how we're doing this? We've said fiscal consolidation. Is it because now we're changing gears and saying to ourselves we're not going to fund things like the SOEs? Or is it now just a case of now we're really saying there is no belt to even begin with, so we can't tighten anymore?
No. You know, we're not doing things over, same thing over and over again. I disagree with you there. The conditions and the economic circumstances differ from how they were in 2011 to now, 10 years later, how they are in 2021. It's different. You know, let's ask ourselves this question, Arabil. What is the opposite of fiscal consolidation? There's an expectation out there that you must just spend until you cannot afford anymore. The worrying factor is that when we look at our debt situation and our debt metrics, it becomes unaffordable. We have to continuously avoid a situation where we will not be able to service our debt. When that happens, we will have collapsed this country. So I think you must look at the environment, ask yourself, what are the reasons? Is the economy firing in all cylinders? If the answer is no, that means then we have to go slow, because We are not collecting, we are spending, we cannot spend our way more than what we are able to afford. So that's in simple language, that's the balancing act that we are trying to do. Our revenues cannot be far lower than what we're spending money off. So our spending should be actually come in line and should be at acceptable debt levels. And that's why we're worrying that the economy, as the size of our economy, cannot absorb huge amounts of debt to a point where they become unsustainable. Sustainability goes hand in hand with fiscal consolidation. These things are supposed to be linking, and we have to look at them in tandem. You cannot divorce them from each other.
Is 83% debt of GDP then an acceptable figure for us? And I say that we've now been spending. We have been spending. Despite fiscal consolidation, we have 350 billion rand worth of guarantees set out on Eskom, which we said we would continue not to fund. We still have a package that is, of course, linked to Eskom at present, right? Maybe no new money, but still money there. SAA had been saved. Now we're saying we're going to try and do away with Mango, perhaps, in some way or other. We still had the basic income grant in effect, right? The social relief of distress grant that we had been putting out because of COVID-19, fair enough. But all those things, and we're still sitting in an economy where there's no lights, there's 54-hour water shedding, if we can call it that, roads in some instances dilapidated, some infrastructure facilities also hard done by. We seemingly have said fiscal consolidation, but we have spent, and now we're sitting with debt. So is 83% of GDP enough?
Thank you very much. You've characterized our challenge properly in your last statement, because you've identified a whole lot of pressures and issues that currently we are faced with. Now, the key question becomes, should we take on more debt, or should we actually focus on improving productive sectors of the economy and focus on those structural reforms that are necessary to boost this economy and to actually make sure that we are able to employ more people and more people in economic activity? That's the solution. The solution is not only just to spend our way out of the misery that we currently find ourselves in. No. So I it's unsustainable. 83% in my worldview is still very high, because if not, we can as well reach 100% debt to GDP. We're owing people 4 trillion rand. It can't be. We're owing people 4 trillion rand. We are paying 365 billion rand by 2023-24 in interest payment, not even repaying of debt, just the interest debt service cost. So now the health budget is about 240 billion. Mm. We're spending more on paying interest on debt than the total budget of health for the national, for the whole country.
Yeah.
So we should be asking ourselves tough questions. Let's build the economy. Let's focus on those areas and not spend our way out of it. Now, we are able today to say, outline certain things that we'll be very cautious in approaching. We're saying we've got a little bit of money, 120 billion is not enough. It came as a windfall from the mining, in particular, the bulk of it coming from the mining receipts. Now, we said we'll spend 50% of that to repay this debt, which is about 60, another 60 to look at programs that we need to fund. The key question is, do I just give this money to those sectors that will just consume? Or should I make sure that these are once-off costs, because this is a windfall, it's temporary, it's not going to be there, it may not be there tomorrow. So allow us to approach this in a way that is responsible, Arabile, that's sustainable, that ensures that our future generations are not indebted. Already, we are tempering on the really future, making sure that our future generations are indebted to unsustainable levels. So I think fiscal consolidation currently addresses issues around debt sustainability, addresses around the fact that you want to burden future generations with the current debt that you're taking on. So we have to be responsible and very careful in addressing some of the challenges that are currently facing us.
We certainly will hold you account to this one now, Dondo. It's going to have to be very, very tight. Fiscal consolidation, the more you continue to give to, for example, the SOEs or any other projects of that kind, it's going to start getting very difficult. You have, as you said, already indebted future generations as well. Dondo Mokgatjane, Director General at National Treasury, thank you so much for your time. Still, as we unpack this medium-term budget policy statement, two economists joining me on the line from Momentum. We have Sanisha Pakrisami and then from from Citibank. We also have Gina Schumann. Ladies, it's a good evening to both of you. Gina, start off with you very quickly. Do you buy it?
Do I buy the budget? Well, I buy everything that the DG just said. I mean, you know, to be honest, this is not about putting the fact that Treasury has to manage expenditure very carefully on the fact that we are not growing. I mean, you mentioned doing things over and over again. Well, I'll tell you one thing this economy has tried to do over and over again is promise that we will have growth, whereas that growth has not materialized. And you can't just blame it on COVID either. You know, we entered COVID with a recession. So Treasury's on a very fine line here, trying to manage expenditure. They're growing spending pressures in the economy because we've had insufficient growth that is not inclusive for job creation. And so I commend them on this budget. It's a very difficult task.
Yeah, Sanisha, in the United, to borrow a phrase from the United States, are very late. Promises made, promises kept. The big issue here is going to be keeping those promises now, isn't it?
Gina. Yes, definitely. So, I mean, in the past, we've often said, you know, the proof is in the pudding. As we know, many of these numbers are just fiscal projections, and we have to see the economy playing out as they have envisaged in order for us to achieve the revenue assumptions and to achieve the constraint on the expenditure side. So we will see in future months whether we are, in fact, able to collect the revenues as Treasury has outlined and whether Treasury has enough restraint on the expenditure side in order to achieve fiscal consolidation and debt stabilization in the medium term.
Yeah, so it does certainly ring the right kind of messages, right? I mean, to say and give a hard stance of what the minister called tough love to the SOEs and say to them, you're no longer getting money from us, you're going to have to find a way forward. It unfortunately, at the same time, does still leave them in the lurch though, doesn't it?
Indeed. You know, going forward, we really need to see an acceleration of structural reform efforts being made in order to prop up the growth lever. We know that there are a couple of levers in which we can pull in order to get that fiscal consolidation and relief on debt. You know, trying to stick to the revenue targets is one that is dependent on economic growth. The other is, of course, the expenditure side.
Yeah, it's going to be very tough on that one. Gina, we still speak the minister, not necessarily too keen on something called the basic income grant and that discussion. Does that point to the right signals also in that we won't just be spending money? We're going to try and instead push for growth, push for those reforms, and those reforms need to come sooner rather than later, right?
I haven't created much of a track record of credibility in terms of reform, but we can still only hope, because while I think we all agree in South Africa that we have far too high levels of poverty and unemployment, I mean, record highs across the world, and we think that everyone should not be living in those conditions and everyone should receive income, I think that's a broad consensus. The question here is, how do you finance it? But not just finance it right now. How do you finance a basic income grant that is at risk of growing and growing and growing and crowding out other expenditure? Because let me say one thing that echoed from what the DG was saying earlier. We only have so much revenue in South Africa. Our revenue line will not grow because we're employing people. It can only really grow rapidly at this point if you're going to tax more. So I think you need to ask South Africans whether they're willing to be taxed more and whether that tax is sustainable in the future. Debt servicing costs are 21% of that tax revenue already. So to add a basic income grant into that, you have to be absolutely sure that you can sustainably finance it into the future without having to give more and more and more to people simply because they're just not getting better off because of employment.
They certainly aren't. Ladies, thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it this evening. Then Sanisha Pakrisami, economist at Momentum, and Citibank economist Gina Schumann joining us as we unpack that medium-term budget policy statement by the finance minister.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, the markets seem to have reacted quite positively. 1.25% higher is the JSE All Share to close out the day. Even the local currency still faring better off, almost 20 cents better now at 15.22 against the US dollar. Rudy Fundamatova, portfolio manager at AdviceWorks, I guess all hinged on that medium-term budget policy statement in a sense, especially on the local front.
Yeah, I think it is certainly helpful. I mean, you know, I think the continuity of what's being said is very positive, and no major negative surprises. Positive speak of involving the private sector in being part of the solution, I think, is all very useful. So a lot of that helped the market, I think, through the day. But the real driver, I think, has been a significant pickup in commodity prices overnight. You know, we had dreadful inflation data out of the US yesterday. Inflation came in the highest since 1990. And as a result, gold prices have moved up quite nicely. And our commodity sector benefited substantially from that on the day.
Yeah, in getting, you know, things like that commodity price sort of booming and then helping still on the local front, especially when it comes to the local currency, then one sort of just looks at the market and just thinks to themselves, well, you've got companies that can perhaps take advantage of that. I mean, the cross companies, the likes of Naspers, et cetera, will certainly enjoy a similar windfall in this regard, right? And I mean, this will bode well for them.
It absolutely will. If our commodity companies can produce more earnings, it just means, you know, the tax revenues also obviously are sustained for a longer period, and that spills over to the rest of the manufacturing and all the support businesses in the economy as well. So absolutely, they can take advantage. And our mining companies generally at the moment have very, very strong balance sheets. You know, they're in a much different and healthier space than they were in 2007, 2008. They've been consolidating and then sorting out their balance sheets, becoming operationally a lot more productive, and I think are very well placed to contribute.
How much more impact is there still perhaps in the market from the fact that the US have said that they're going to begin tapering? And yes, it's a slow process, but has the market sort of swallowed that news sufficiently now and sort of said to themselves, well, yeah, this was what we expected. This is pretty much as is. Now we wait for the rest of the globe to kind of catch up. Is perhaps the market awaiting, for example, our MPC next week to decide, yeah, we're going to start perhaps getting back to some sense of normality when it comes to those interest rates?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly being telegraphed very effectively. I don't know that the market is particularly pricing correctly for it yet. It's a very difficult position. You know, we see significant evidence of inflation coming through at this stage, but how sustained that's going to be is an unknown. A big chunk of the inflation we're seeing at the moment is almost contrived inflation, partly due to bottlenecks, which are supply lines and the like, and those sort of pressures tend to ease off as time goes. We're seeing some of them ease at the moment already. The supply of semiconductors, for example, seems to be normalizing somewhat. Port congestions are starting to normalize somewhat. So we can hope that we see more of that. The very high energy prices at the moment is not because there's a shortage of oil. It's OPEC being obstinate and manipulating the prices higher. So as some of these things normalize, hopefully we can see inflation, you know, not continuing to accelerate at current rates. If it does continue to accelerate at current rates, that makes markets very vulnerable to higher interest rates. There's a lot of debt around, and there's certainly a lot of valuations, especially in developed markets, are quite stretched. So we're on a bit of a knife edge at the moment.
Yeah, let's certainly see how things fare. Rudy van der Merwe, appreciate your time this evening. Portfolio manager at AdviceWorks, then joining us for our market commentary.
Absa is fueling tomorrow's energy today with this commitment to facilitating conversations that seek to fuel the sustainable future of the African upstream at this year's Africa Oil Week. Only on The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
So how major are the changes then to taxes when it comes to that medium-term budget policy statement delivered today by the finance minister, Enoch Godongwana? Let's chat to Charles De Wet, tax executive at ENS Africa, joining us now. Not much by the way of those tax, income tax sort of conversations then in this one, Charles, but it will get interesting that we need to be a little bit aware that the best way for the country to, I suppose, get any more money is going to be through increased taxes somehow.
Yeah, hi, Arabella. I mean, that's exactly the point. At some point in time, we're going to have to up the revenue collection. I mean, sort of historically, we don't expect today to be a big tax announcement. Most of the tax amount announcements are made as part and parcel of the February budget. What was significant, though, and that also typically happens on a day like today, is the final tax amendment bill was introduced by the minister at the beginning of his speech. And there's some interesting sort of telltales in that that lead to the broader tax conversation. Now, you may recall that in the budget, the minister announced that there was a program to reduce the corporate tax rate because we are not really competitive in international terms. But that was connected to two particular policy directions, and that was a limitation on the deduction of interest, and then also a limitation on the transfer of assessed losses. Now, there was quite a lot of reaction when that was put into the draft legislation, and a number of commentators pushed back against that. What's interesting and what is in today's documentation is that while they have amended and accepted some of the changes, those provisions are still there. But what they have done is it will only apply from a date to be announced in the future. It won't come into effect immediately. Now, that's an interesting direction to do things. It means that they believe they've had the debate and they don't want to have it again, which gives a little bit of certainty, and at the same time maybe indicates that, sort of a reduction in corporate tax rate is still on the cards.
Sure. I mean, if that reduction were to come in place, though, I mean, would that really increase sort of the investment in the country, for example? Because some would say, okay, well, you have lower tax rates. It means that, we're going to get charged less and we have more revenue to kind of invest in this country. Do you think that really becomes the case if that was to kind of be it from a tax perspective?
That was certainly the conventional thinking sort of before COVID-19 hit us, that there was a global pressure to reduce tax rates, and we saw a number of countries doing that. So we were certainly not competitive from that perspective. But what we have seen recently is that the UK pushed up its tax rate. So I think there's been a little bit of a reverse around that. But there is some sort of if you look at the detail of the projections and the tax revenue going forward, there's some sort of interesting clues in terms of what their strategy may be as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, I think that's certainly going to be one to kind of watch really for really where to from here as well on that front. Do you see any other changes, happening in near term, even if it is just, next year, to kind of find more money? I mean, doesn't look like VAT is going to be the next one in that sense, because we've already done that maybe 3 or so years ago. Increasing the actual income tax, that may be a tough one. If you decrease corporate tax, that may be, the next thing, but that doesn't necessarily help your fiscus too much as yet. The other thing you could possibly do is just increase that sugar tax, but that won't add enough to the fiscus, surely.
No, so, sugar tax, all those smaller taxes, while they generate some money, there's not very much of that they generate. That won't make a difference. If you look at the trend in the, for the next 3 years, one of the sort of hallmarks almost of the South African tax system is that the individuals carry the biggest burden of tax. And, if you look at that, that's been sitting close to 40%, and it seems to, in the next 3 years, stay at that kind of level. The increases are quite big, though, in relation to sort of economic growth and so on. If you look for 2022, they almost projecting an 11% increase for individuals. But in 2023, and this seems to be when the corporate tax rate will be reduced, there's a big reduction in that. But what you're seeing as part and parcel of that trend is a bigger move to indirect taxes. Whereas traditionally VAT has pretty much had it about 25% of the total tax take. In the next 3 years, it seems to be heading up to about 30%. I don't see a rate increase in that, though. As you say, we had a rate increase in 2018, and I've always believed that this is the place where they could collect more money. But very much is focused about what Commissioner Kizveta said in terms of the efficiencies, the money that they've been spending at SARS. The windfalls that they've got in the mining industry, kind of taking advantage of that, but also increasing their efficiency and collecting more tax off the back of that. So that kind of seems to be the direction that they're moving in.
Always good chatting to you then. Charles DeVette, Tax Executive at ENS Africa. Thank you so much for that time. Indeed, income tax, certainly the most critical and important part there. The one driving force, of course, to that budget time and time again.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, here's a man who used to be a part of that budget office at National Treasury. Today would have been one of those crackerjack days where Michael Sacks would have had to answer quite a few questions then coming up from either journalists or other ratings agencies and the like as well. Michael Sacks, thank you so much for joining us this evening here on The Money Show. Your thoughts then, just that medium-term budget policy statement, did that offer sort of a sense that indeed we will get fiscal consolidation done?
I suppose if you put it like that, it's a very difficult question. I think Treasury did the best they could. But the challenge when thinking about fiscal consolidation, at least on the expenditure side, is that essentially, I think rightly, Treasury has accommodated the windfall in revenue by increasing spending this year by about 60 billion rand. And what that has done is accommodated the very large or the above inflation wage increase that public servants secured in their negotiation with the state, and accommodated the increase in the social extension of the social grant and the president's economic stimulus program. And all of those three things are likely to be permanent increases in expenditure. Now, I think Treasury was right to use part of the revenue windfall to fund that. The problem is that the fiscal consolidation on the expenditure side still remains to be done, and now it is even tougher to achieve, and that is penciled in for next year.
Yeah.
And of course, things are easier today, but next year looks a little bit more tougher. And it's more tougher, if I can use that wrong English, because we don't know where global conditions are going to be, and it's quite possible that commodity support will ease and global monetary support will also become tougher. And the ANC's elections are approaching fast.
Yeah.
And so the honest truth is that most of the action in this medium-term budget policy statement was actually about this current year, 2021,
sure,
where spending was increased by 60 billion and the task of achieving the fiscal consolidation is left open. And I think that's the only way really to do it, because the fiscal consolidation depends on political decisions which cabinet and the president need to champion.
Mm.
And without those political decisions, you can't really commit the budget to anything.
Michael, the DG disagreed with me in a sense that we aren't doing the same things over and over, that indeed things were actually slightly different. We weren't, it seems that fiscal consolidation had many various and different forms. Is that really the case? I mean, I feel as though we've kind of always said that we're going to tighten our belts, ensure that fiscally we're sound, we're going to keep debt in check. And yes, fine, COVID-19 did impact that quite severely. But we had already been going overboard quite a bit, especially when it comes to things like our expenses.
So, look, there is a sense in which we are doing the same things over and over again. And once again, we have a framework that appears to reach debt stabilization after 3 years, but is vulnerable to a whole lot of risk. And there is certainly a fiscal squeeze. And if you look at some of the numbers presented today about, especially in the fiscal risk section about the crisis, the fiscal crisis that is going on at local government, and the accumulation of arrears in provincial government. The squeeze is on spending, and the squeeze has been on spending for 10 years. And yes, there's a sense in which we're repeating the same thing over and over again, but that is the condition that the country faces, which is a result of a contradiction between slowing growth on the one hand and falling per capita income on the one hand, and policy ambition to achieve a basic income grant or national health insurance or free tertiary education or all of the above inflation increases for public servants. All of those are being continued to be pursued by the political leadership in very real ways. And on the other, and those are in contradiction with fiscal consolidation. So ultimately, unless that kind of policy incoherence at the heart of government is resolved, that government makes a choice one way or the other, we are going to keep banging our head against the same wall over and over again. Of course, the other way out would be to somehow engineer a serious process of economic growth, but that doesn't seem to be emerging either.
Eventually, though, we have to try and find growth, right? So even if it means that we put in the right things in place now for eventual growth at some stage, surely that would have been a great basis to begin with, right? So are we even there? Are we even at a point where we're doing some of that right, at least?
I don't really think so, because I mean, I think, look, there are movements in the right direction, in my view. I think a major constraint on growth is the network industries, which are all presided over by large public monopolies that are inefficient and raise costs. And unless you grasp that nettle, which means, say, for example, in the case of electricity, being very clear about a path of reform that is going to fundamentally change the structure of industry and being able to articulate a vision and stick to a program that then has credibility, then we might have a basis for some process of growth. But I don't get the sense that government is prepared to grasp that nettle, and it more feels like pulling teeth to in various different directions. So that's the one problem. The other is that, quite frankly, there's this contradiction at the heart of government. The president is talking a language of job stimulus and the extension of basic income support on the one hand, and Treasury is talking a language of fiscal consolidation on the other hand.
Yeah.
And then the whole issue of the reform of the state-owned company sector is kind of hanging, is kind of the elephant in the room, which and that creates huge problems both for fiscal consolidation, but also stymies any attempt by government to lead a public investment program, because the state-owned companies are really the vehicles of public investment, and without balance sheets that are effective and institutions that are effective in the state-owned company sector,
sure.
You're not going to get the public investment program. So I there are some good intentions,
yeah.
But if you, in my view, if you put it all together on one page, it doesn't add up to a coherent and credible growth program.
Well, that becomes even scarier. Michael Sachs, appreciate the time, though. Thank you so much for joining us. Former head of National Treasury's budget office there, the medium-term budget policy statement, maybe not necessarily matching up to the standards we'd hope for.
702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
The Money Show with myself, Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield, is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, fueling tomorrow's energy today at Africa Oil Week. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. So we turn our attention then to some company results having come out as well then today. The big pay company that you certainly watch a lot of your series and your episodes on, MultiChoice, having delivered a set of earnings then today, A very interesting set having come out today. The rest of Africa, indeed, joining multi-choice at a faster rate than South Africa does. So they're outside of South Africa, base certainly growing a little bit quicker than here locally. We're joined then by the CFO of multi-choice. That's Tim Jacobs, joins us on the line now. Tim, thank you so much for the time this evening. Does that worry you at all, that your subscriber base outside of South Africa is growing quicker than locally? Or is that just a formulation of, I suppose, saturation somewhat in the market?
Thank you so much, and good evening to all your listeners. I think there are two components to that. I think the South African market that we've been in for slightly longer than the rest of Africa is a more mature market. And we are probably a little bit more saturated and penetrated in the premium and mid-market segments. We're still seeing some growth in South Africa in the mass market. In the rest of Africa, however, when we changed our strategy in 2017 to a value strategy, we opened up a significant ability to target customers that were in the mass and middle market. And that opportunity is still significant across many more countries than we have just in the South African market. So we'd expect the growth rate in the rest of Africa to continue to outperform the growth rate in South Africa for some time to come.
That growth rate for some time to come is going to obviously be based on just the competition as well that you continue to face here locally. And I mean, you've seen quite a bit of that, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. That has certainly changed the way consumers are consuming pay TV and the like as well. How do you make sure you stay ahead? I mean, are you investing a little bit more into the content now? Are you creating as much more of that local sort of documentary stuff that goes into what people perhaps consume a little bit more in the different areas?
Absolutely. A key part of our strategy is a massive investment into local content, which we believe is a key differentiator for us. We've increased the number of hours that we produced in the first 6 months of this year by 41% over last year. And we are currently spending 45% of our total general entertainment spend on local content. So that's up from 42% last year. So a significant improvement there. Also, we are working very hard to digitize the company. So in other words, make sure that people, as we move forward and people have access to, for example, OTT services, that they can enjoy the DStv and Showmax brands and other products that we're going to bring to market on an OTT platform rather than just on satellite.
In doing that, of course, you have the sports functionality, which of course is quite huge, particularly on the continent too. Keeping up with that and of course the licensing agreements and all of those issues, how do you make sure you fit demand into all of that and ensure that cost effectiveness is still primary aim here?
Yeah, so sport is I suppose, our two key differentiating factors in the marketplace, so local content and sports. General entertainment tends to be what you compete against with the other international players. I think sports, we've obviously got a long history with being one of the best sources of sport as a collective anywhere in the world. The breadth and the depth of our sport offering is enormous. We obviously focus very much on the major brands. So, for example, in South Africa, the PSL, rugby, and of course the EPL brands. But you would have seen we've also been moving very strongly into, for example, school sports and looking at brands that kind of really attract families and the younger generation. And that has turned out to be significantly successful. And we're producing hundreds of matches a year, using kind of new technology that allows us to do this very cost effectively. So we're looking at a multifaceted approach to developing sports content for the markets that we serve.
Yeah, and that's actually going to be more important than anything else, I suppose, to try and ensure that it does fit into that mold as much as possible then. In terms of your some issues that you may still have when it comes to Nigeria as well, the tax issues that go on there as well, it's a multi-billion rand tax dispute that is going on that front. You confident that you'll get that one resolved soon enough? I mean, that must be hindering progress a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, this is not the first time we've had tax disputes on the continent. We don't often have to play them out in the court of public opinion. But the real issue here is a misunderstanding about how our subscriber numbers are calculated, and that in turn, you know, translates into some tax numbers. We are very confident that our numbers are absolutely above board. They've been audited. And it's just a case of getting the merits of the case heard. At the moment, the various cases that we've got running with the tribunal are still dealing with the technicalities of actually hearing the merits of the case. So we're still busy just going through the legal process. But at the same time, as we're looking at the legal process and protecting our rights in Nigeria, we are also having discussions with the revenue authorities to try and see if we can find a way to get the audit done and to resolve this in a more, let's call it a less public and less legalistic way.
Yeah, that's going to be absolutely crucial to the business. Would you say that new innovations are certainly on the way, things consumers can certainly look out for? And I mean, many people always question pricing and the like, but you still maintain very competitive in this market.
Yes, that's right. I think what we've been able to demonstrate over the last couple of years is that we're one of the markets in the world that is able to grow both the OTT base as well as the linear base at the same time. And we've been able to do that across the continent. And of course, we do that by introducing new products and services on a regular basis. The supply chain issues around chipsets, for example, has meant that we've had a slight delay in bringing our new streamer product, Streamer Decoder, to the market, which is directly OTT only. But that's just a kind of a matter of time. And as soon as those supply chain issues are resolved, those products will come to market as well.
Yep, certainly an interesting one there. We'll certainly see how things continue to go out, particularly when it comes to that part of the scale. Things like Showmax, has that really eaten into the market as you would have liked? I mean, has it grown the way you would have you liked it to? I mean, considering, as we've noted a little bit earlier, the amount of competition that is in that online consumption space.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I think the OTT market, we've always maintained that the OTT market in South Africa in particular, and the continent, is actually worse than South Africa, will develop slower than people are expecting. I think a lot of people look at the international markets and they think that the same is going to replicate themselves in Africa. The reality is that two things: one, broadband connectivity, whether that's via mobile or whether it's via fixed line broadband, and data costs are two of the big hindrances to a full adoption of a kind of an OTT consumer shift. It's going to happen over time. We are seeing prices coming down and we are seeing penetration of broadband happening, you know, more and more across the continent, but it tends to be a little bit slower. And that means that all the OTT competitors are in the same boat. So, you know, when you look at the penetration levels in some of the first world countries and how fast it's been a significant slower journey in the South African continent. It's growing, but it's allowing us to continue to grow our linear products at the same time. So we don't see at the moment that it's a substitution. It's more of a complementary product, and it's opening up a new set of content for consumers. And of course, with our super aggregation strategy, we currently have Netflix, Amazon Prime, and YouTube on our, for example, our Ultra Box.
Yeah.
We're looking to bring a much easier user interface and user interaction with those types of content, so that they can do all of that through their DStv account.
Are you looking to enter the international scale? And let me give an example here. I mean, you have the likes of, you know, for example, Netflix, who anywhere in the world you can still log on with the exact same password. You, yes, find certain features, certain things that are available in certain areas may not necessarily be available in that space you're in too, but you certainly could log on to it from different platforms or different countries, should I say, rather. Would MultiChoice be looking to head in that way at any point? I mean, a Showmax could, for example, do that. Is that something you consider?
Look, it is a possibility. It's not something that we're considering at the moment. And the reason for that is it's got to do with the size of the portfolio of content that you can produce each year. What we do is we've taken a much more aggressive stance on taking our series and movies and selling those into the international market. And we've seen some significant traction on that over the last 6 months. So that's been how we're getting our content, our localized content that we own, into the international space. But we're not looking to take necessarily Showmax International.
Yeah. Irdeto, that adding quite a bit of a solid performance too.
Indeed it is. That is a great little business. It has been growing its market share in the traditional space, media security space, over the last couple of years. It continues to win tier one clients. And of course, it's very focused on some of the new exciting areas of business development, Internet of Things, mobile, connected transport, for example, and gaming, where the growth rates are significantly higher than their traditional business. And they've been doing very nicely for us, and they're really on a nice growth trajectory.
Tim Jacobs, let's catch up again when the numbers come out for the full year as well. CFO at MultiChoice joining us then as we unpack the interim results then from MultiChoice, having just come out then. A set of earnings that I suppose will be of keen interest to the market and where to from here, especially getting into that video entertainment space.
The Money Show.
Small business.
With Pavlo Fatidis.
Small business focus then with Pavlo Fatidis, founder at Auric Business Accelerator. So good evening to you, Pavlo. Hope you're well.
I'm very well. And how are you keeping?
Yeah, certainly could be better. Always could be better. But, you know, we keep fighting on. Let's get straight into it then today. Your focus then this evening?
Well, there are a lot of people who aren't keeping very well, Ribile. A lot of people are really miserable at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, if I think of probably, I'd say the last 2 weeks of telephone calls that I've been dealing with, mostly they're from mid-tier business owners, established business owners. They are mostly growth-minded business owners. And the thing about being growth-minded is if you have a growth-orientated attitude in your business, the likelihood is you're going to behave in such a way to generate that growth, because your behavior is guided by your attitude.
Mm.
And your behavior then gives you the result of all that activity. And in many cases, it's not growth at the moment. And then I get into the conversation, and there's this ongoing theme which has been building over the last 6 months or so, coming out from business saying, you know, the covenant, the deal, the agreement, the unspoken agreement, the implied agreement between ourselves and government has been breached. It's been broken. And when I say, well, what do you mean by that? They say, well, think of the logic of why we do what we do. So we do what we do to make money. You need to do something to survive. You need to do something to create economy for yourself. We do what we do in order to make a difference in our clients' or customers' lives, because if you didn't make a difference, you wouldn't be doing anything. Your business would be failing. And we do so with very little to start, because most people are not born with good money behind them, a silver spoon in their mouths. Most people go into business out of necessity, and it takes time. It really takes time, especially in the South African economy, to build a business to any meaningful significance. And that carries risk, it carries sacrifice. And what we would expect is if we are to do that, by making a difference to the South African economy, by making a difference to society, by creating employment, by paying our taxes, we should be able to do so in an environment where at least we can rely on what government says it will do. For example, we should be able to rely on reliable electricity. At least we should be able to rely on electricity inflation figures that aren't skyrocketing. At least we should be able to rely on government protecting our investments. And I said, but what do you mean from that? And they say, from an electricity point of view, the ruling party itself is conflicted around a single strategy. The one hand says this, the other hand says that. And whilst they comfortably eat taxes, we burn in business waiting for a final position that is turned into action to resolve the problems. And the riots, what did you mean by that? Well, who's gone to jail for instigating the riots, for destroying our property, for destroying everything that we have built? We're still waiting for insurance payouts. The covenant between us is broken. So Aribila, the only thing I can do is direct them to what can you do then, if that's the case?
Mm.
And this is where it gets really interesting. And I want to talk about being busy, but what does it mean?
Sure. And I suppose, you know, one looks at it and thinks to themselves, change is one thing. You wanting to feed your family is obviously critical, and the other thing as well here. But we're sitting with a society where just being able to get one thing right, a form of payment, just being paid on time, that's just incredible. Doesn't happen. It's the simplest, right? You've committed to the service. The service has been given to you to your standard, to your liking, yeah. And still no payment. That's the suffering of small businesses.
Well, it's the suffering of many businesses, not only small businesses, You know, it creates such an interesting scenario. And if you look at where we are, more so now than ever before, the covenant between the private sector and government is crucial to take this country forward. Government sits in a situation where it has no more money. And many would say, thankfully, because it's not behaved well with the money that it did have. I've been reading extensively around the cost of Eskom and what's happened to the money, like most South Africans. So maybe it's a good thing that government doesn't have money. But what government also doesn't have is the trust and confidence of the private sector. And the private sector is the only means at the moment that we have available to us for service delivery. And I'm talking about the basics, nothing fancy. So if that covenant is not rectified and not fixed, I have concerns around what it means, not only for plowing and laying the seeds for our future economy to grow, because in an environment where you cannot get basic services right, you have further instability. When you have further instability, you have a lack of investment taking place. So if that environment is not sorted and not fixed, we are going to drag on, as they say, kicking the can down the road, waiting for something to change. And the point you make about payments, just payments alone, how long has that discussion been going on? And yet still today, I have clients, I have business owners, lots of them, that still don't get paid for services rendered and services delivered. So where does it begin and where does it end? Whose responsibility is it? And the sad reality is, if all you have control over is your own direct action, then take that action and direct it into something that will grow the business beyond relying on the covenant, the so-called covenant that we have with government. And that is not so easy, especially on the South African rand, and especially on the reputation we have at the moment in markets that are set to growth. The US next year, facing around 6% growth. The UK, Europe, looking at between 5% and 6%.
Yeah.
How do we get there?
Yeah.
It's the challenge.
We're looking at just 5.1% locally. And that is just based on hopefully our own growth, right? And that's just a bounce back from last year. It doesn't mean that that's a consistent. Growth. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's consistent.
That's not good. No. Oh. The real run rate are running at below 1%.
Yeah. So where to? So what do we do? What do we do from here, Pablo?
This covenant has to be sorted. This agreement has to be sorted. And I know that government likes to work with big business, very big business, because big business is very well organized. But the reality is there are around 800 companies in South Africa that generate a taxable income of 100 million rand a year or more. 800. And there are about 45,000 businesses in the mid-tier space that are the true engine of the economy. We need to figure out a way where beyond just platitudes and conventions and shiny seminars, government and small business find a way to reach each other. Because if that doesn't happen, the engine that drives this economy stalls.
Sure. And that stalling could be the end of all of us. Pavlo Fatidis, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it this evening. Founder at Auric Business Accelerator, joining us this evening for our small business focus, as usual, on a Thursday evening.
Absa is fueling tomorrow's energy today with this commitment to facilitating conversations that seek to fuel the sustainable future of the African upstream at this year's Africa Oil Week. Only on The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
This personal finance feature is brought to you by IG Markets. IG Markets South Africa is an authorized financial services provider. CFD losses can exceed your deposits. We're joined then, of course, by Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital, joining us this evening. Good evening to you then, Warren. I hope you're very well. Let's just start things off then with perhaps a look at asset swaps. I mean, how are things faring here?
It's an interesting time, Arabile, with these, because you know, a lot of people who have money in living annuities, endowments, and tax-free savings accounts are finding themselves in a position where the provider of these products is telling them that they're not allowed to get as much of the money as you know, exposed to international markets as they would like. So just, you know, a little bit of background. You know, a living annuity, for example, is not controlled by Regulation 28, which you know, is the regulations that control the rest of retirement funds, and so that means that normally a living annuity can have, you know, anything from 100% of its money in South Africa to 100% invested overseas. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, there are quite a lot of the very big product providers, especially those that are investment companies, you know, unit trust companies, where they're limiting the amount that that living annuities can actually allocate to offshore markets. And so all of a sudden, you know, on The Money Show, we're getting lots of questions now from people saying, hang on, you know, what's going on? Is this new regulation? You know, is this the government, you know, the dreaded government? Are they interfering? Yeah. Are they reversing exchange controls or something? And lots of conspiracy theories abound. And so just, you know, very quickly, that's not the case at all. What's happening at the moment is that these companies have a limit as life assurance companies, because your retirement funds are actually, you know, fall under the Life Assurance Act as well, and especially the living annuities. And they're allowed to invest a maximum of 40% of their total money in international markets. So when they have too much money invested in international markets, they are forced by the regulators to take action to make sure that balance gets restored again. And so that's what's happening now, is it's just these investment companies are doing their best now to let that situation normalize by restricting how much living annuities can then invest overseas. And unfortunately, tax-free savings fall into that category as well for these investment companies. So there's no conspiracy theory, no change in regulation. It's something that's happened a few times in the last decade or two, so not something to be too concerned about. When market trends continue, you'll find that situation reverses again.
Yeah.
So no, unfortunately, no conspiracy theories, nothing to get excited about, just normal market moves.
Yeah, I was actually about to even touch on those tax-free savings accounts. I mean, with them falling in the same category, do you think fears around this sort of just halts investments into it? Or, you know, do people sort of become more rational and sort of ask the question and then realize, okay, well, we're still good to go here?
Well, I guess, Arabile, that's your and my job, is to help them get rational.
Yeah.
And stop, you know, stop the fear, because it's just simple fear mongering, and it's really not sensible at all. You know, in truth, if you've got a, you know, an investment, let's say in a tax free that buys the you know, the top companies in South Africa, the top 40, top 50 companies, a heck of a lot of those businesses earn you know, a big chunk of their money in the global markets, not just in South Africa. So you've got really good rand hedging and diversification already. So, you know, a really bad decision would be to stop investing, you know, tax-free altogether, because, you know, that's really a huge engine of growth for a lot of people for their long-term savings. So my view is, you know, if you've got a limit, you know, if your product provider says, sorry, you know, we're limiting your capacity, then you've got two choices, you know, invest in a South African equity index instead, or look for a different product provider that doesn't have the same restrictions. But the choice not to make, the decision not to make, is to stop investing in your tax-free. I just think that's a no-brainer decision. You just don't do that.
Yeah, and many people are bound to sort of get a sense that, oh, maybe, you know what, they might not be able to, or maybe they look at this and go, oh my goodness, it's just not it for them, and won't necessarily be the investment platform they look to in a while or so. So yeah, I think that space is certainly going to be interesting, one to certainly touch on and look towards as well. But our primary feature, or primary look today, retirement planning, that seems to be taking a beating. And I mean, one would have even thought from COVID-19 that was already difficult enough, because people may have even been looking to withdraw or draw from their savings. And now it's still the same case, right? Nothing has really changed by the seams of it. It just feels like it's more of the same. Still taking a beating. Difficult to plan for that retirement.
100% right, Arabila. And I'm sitting here talking to you, with the sound of generators all around me. With my neighbors, so because we're in load shedding, and that's just not helping at all either, and I think that's just contributing to an already dire situation, and I think for people that are in this position where they're let's say a few years to a decade or so from retirement, they're really panicking, because they're looking at their retirement age, it's now rushing at them at an accelerating rate, it feels like. And suddenly they just know that their savings aren't enough. The capital that they have got invested has probably taken a bit of a knock as well. And so they start to feel somewhat hopeless. And I think that's really the message for tonight, is just to understand that you've got so many different levers to pull when you're planning your retirement. And it's never hopeless. I think that's a critical message here. One of the real benefits of investing is if you give yourself time. Time becomes your hugest and by far your biggest ally in your investment career, and so in a situation like this, if the world and COVID and pandemics and blackouts and all of those things have given you a knock, then just understand that you might need to just delay your retirement plan somewhat. So if you were planning to retire at 65 and you're currently 55 and you just know that your goal's just been moved out of it, you can always make some decisions. So for example, take the decision to perhaps work at 2 or 3 years longer, but don't treat that as kind of a prison sentence where you say, gee, I really hate my job, and now this guy on the radio is telling me I've got to work for an extra 2 or 3 years, and I couldn't see that happening. You can make some changes. For example, at age 65, choose a different path, choose a different career where perhaps you say, if you were used to earning 50,000 rand a month, go and choose something that gives you a lot more purpose, where your skills are still going to be valued, but perhaps you're only earning 20,000 rand a month. That might feel like a big drop in terms of income, but remember, what you're doing is you're actually buying time. You're not trying to earn the most amount of money possible, because every year that you're earning an additional income past your planned retirement age means that you're not drawing on your investments, and you're managing to actually either save a bit or just not not spend capital, and so it almost has a double effect. So using that 20,000 rand example, it's not just the 20,000 rand that you're earning, it's the 20,000 rand you're not drawing from your investments. So you could actually view that as a 40,000 rand swing. And then going back to my example, if you were earning 50,000 rand at retirement, 40,000 rand swing is not such a big difference between what you were earning and what you're saving. And if you're finding purpose in your work and you're finding enjoyment in something that's less stressed, but more purposeful, that gives a huge benefit to life, in fact. And this isn't a motivational talk, but the reality is, when we stop work, that doesn't mean life stops. So if we can find a way to earn some money, which is good for our retirement planning, and get some enjoyment and get some purpose, to me that sounds like a triple win. And so I'm not trying to put lipstick on the bulldog. It's tough when your retirement planning takes a knock. But don't look at this as a situation where you have no choice and kind of a prison sentence of working in a job that you really hate.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing there is just be careful to kind of change your risks of your investments because you've taken a knock. I think one of the things that really worries me is, people suddenly go, hang on, I don't have enough retirement capital now. I don't have enough time. I'm going to increase the risk of my retirement savings already, and take more risk than I really should because I need to catch up on lost capital. And that's a really catastrophic decision, because if you're increasing the potential growth of your money, which sounds really exciting, what you need to remember is you're also increasing the potential losses at a time when you probably can't afford to let them recover. So unfortunately, the one thing you really can't do is, you know, is add steroids to your investment portfolio and think, you know, now I'm going to just take, you know, even more risk for more growth, because, you know, the risk is the part you should be focusing on. You need to protect your capital and give it time to grow. And that means, you know, make some changes, but not necessarily to your investments.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's very interesting notion here to don't take on more risk than you feel like you need to now, taking steroids to your risk on this one. Warren, we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. Then we're still having our personal finance feature with Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital.
Absa is fueling tomorrow's energy today with this commitment to facilitating conversations that seek to fuel the sustainable future of the African upstream at this year's Africa Oil Week. Only on The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Still on to our personal finance feature then. We're talking about retirement planning and how that was taking a beating. Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital, having joined us then as well as usual. Warren, we also had a question then from a Floris van Wyk, I think it was, right?
Yep.
So let's get into that one then. The question, kind of just looking at, good day. I have a newborn son and would like to know, in your opinion, what is the best type and place to start an investment for him, but does not have a lot of tax implications for the parents? I mean, that gets very interesting. And I suppose that's one thing everybody would want to know.
Absolutely. And it's amazing how, you know, how few, you know, parents think about this. Yeah, I know they've got a lot on their plate when their baby's born, and that's a huge adjustment to life. But, you know, this is something that I would suggest parents start thinking about before the baby's born, so that it's taken care of when the time gets busy. But I think maybe just to point out that parents can open accounts in the name of their children already. You know, so when the baby's born and it's got an ID number, parents are already able to open an account for the child, and they just need to sign on behalf of that child and take authority or take control of the investments until the child becomes an adult. And so for the child and for the parent, there are not many tax implications for parents starting a normal investment. You know, let's just say kind of a basic exchange traded fund or a normal unit trust. There's nothing wrong and nothing stopping a parent starting that already in the child's name. But I would take Floris's point if she started an investment in her own name for her child, because then one day when she decided to give that money to her child, she might end up having to pay capital gains tax when that investment was sold, or donations tax if she transferred it. So definitely nothing stops you opening an account in the name of your baby. And I think also the second thing to note is I love tax-free savings accounts for newborns. You know, to start saving for them as early as possible in a tax-free in their own name is to me a brilliant idea, because tax-free savings accounts, the more money you leave in there for the longest period possible, you know that it's growing without any tax. It's not paying income tax. It's not paying dividends tax or capital gains tax. And so, you know, if the newborn can leave it until the age of 25 or 30 years old, that'll probably buy them their house cash. And I think that's an incredible gift to give a child. So my general sense always is to try and open a tax-free. But, you know, if the parents, you know, already have filled up a tax-free for their child or want to do something else, you know, then it just a kind of a, you know, standard unit trust or exchange traded fund is a great idea. Just make sure you take something that's got high potential growth, you know, so something that's got a lot of exposure to shares, you know, not a bank account or a fixed deposit, which is really limiting your growth.
Some questions may be towards even, you know, whether you should be picking something like an education trust, even as well as, you know, as the baby is born, to ensure that when they get to a particular stage in their education, that they're able to kind of, you know, start. Would that be a thing?
Yeah, I know that the product providers love to sell these, you know, so they always package it. And I know it pulls on the heartstrings of parents where they say, you know, this is an education policy for your child. But just to understand that when you scrape off the paint and you look at what's actually underneath the bonnet of that product, it's basically an endowment, almost inevitably. And those things, to me, they've got a huge advantage if you're a maximum, you know, taxpayer. So if you pay income tax at, you know, at 45% or even one bracket below at 40%, and you pay capital gains tax, you know, at a rate of effectively 18%. But it's important to understand that an endowment itself pays income tax at 30%. So for most of us in South Africa, you know, a lot of our people in our country don't pay, you know, income tax at that rate. And so it's actually much more effective for them to rather save the money just in a straight unit trust. Even though the product's called an education, you know, fund or an education policy, just understand, you know, it's just an endowment policy with a nice lick of paint and a you know, like a heartstring pulling marketing gimmick. And I don't like them for that reason. And but don't even get me started on the fees, Arabile, because those are usually quite high as well.
Yeah.
So no, I'm not a fan, to be honest.
Yeah, so picking kind of the right thing here is also going to need quite a bit of research then on our part, right? It's if you're looking to get into something like that, looking for a package for sustain, and obviously the best time to start saving, people always say, is the moment you're born. And if you can't do it for yourself, hopefully your parents are doing it for you. So this is certainly a good move. This is a move and a step in the right direction, really.
It's brilliant. I mean, I just love the idea. You know, I think, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, that you have to save thousands of rands a month for your child. You know, if you can just start, you know, $50 a month every month for, you know, 18 years, it turns out to be a lot of money, especially when that money is starting to grow in itself, you know, and where your money makes money babies, you know, the compound effect of that is just really powerful. So you're right, Arabila. I think just, you know, just getting started with any amount you can and just trying to be consistent by building on that, you know, month after month after month, it has a huge impact over time.
Yeah, always has and always will. That one foundational rule always remains. All right, let's get into our phrase of the week then, Warren. Opportunity cost. What's that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that we tend to lose sight of in the investment world. And a lot of the time, you know, when someone says, gee, I really want you know, I want a really safe investment. You know, I hate to lose money on my investment portfolio. So I don't want to invest in shares. Just to understand that your decision that you're making is actually, there's a lot going on, because let's say if you're saying I want something safe, so you go in and buy, you know, a 5-year fixed deposit at a bank and they you know, give you a wonderful interest rate of 7%. I'm being sarcastic, of course, but 7% a year for the next 5 years. You know, the thing that you need to consider there is, what would a stock market investment, you know, just a straightforward general equity unit trust or a, you know, top 40, top 50, you know, index, what would that do? And the likelihood is that over 5 years, you know, a share index gives you kind of 10 to 12% a year over 5 years. So, you know, you've bought certainty by buying the fixed deposit and getting your 7% a year. But the opportunity cost is the lost growth that you could have got from investing in the stock market over the same time frame. And truthfully, you know, when you're avoiding risk, just to understand that, you know, when you invest in shares, any stock market around the world, it's very rare that a stock market loses value over 5 years. Now, it might lose value over 1 year or 2 years, but if you leave the money invested for 5 years, there are very, very few times where your investment has gone down from the starting point. So the opportunity cost is the lost growth that you could have got from investing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a thing we don't think about a lot.
Warren Ingram, appreciate it. Always good having this personal finance feature with you. I think a lot of learnings always come out of it, and really appreciate you giving that help as well to all the listeners. Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital, for our personal finance feature, retirement planning, and the like, all a part of the conversation.